It's my reflex by now, with an idea as broad as globalism, to ask, what did the writers think? Because the poets and novelists always feel the trends first, and because the Salman Rushdie class of writers has been working these new international themes and markets for years. Zadie Smith's novel, White Teeth, is a favorite among the rising global literati. Still in her mid-20s, Zadie Smith is a sort of embodiment of her global theme. English father, Jamaican mother, she's a prophet of what looks from the outside like a sort of human hybridity.
I think hybridity is only a notion to people who aren't mixed. To people who are mixed, it's as much a fact as having two arms. I never considered it. It was just something that I am. And I've always enjoyed being, not knowing any other kind of life, which is how we all are.
I had been reading White Teeth, underlining, scratching notes, and thinking, this is a perfect distillation of the global idea, when literally I bumped into her in a Harvard Square bookstore and then asked her to talk with us.
I think there's an odd idea amongst a kind of white majority that minorities consider themselves from an attitude of otherness. They don't. They just walk around having themselves as central subjects the way everybody else does. It's impossible to consider yourself as the other or the black guy or the weird Chinese girl. No one thinks of themselves that way. And politics based on that idea don't make any sense to me. It's an unnatural position.
One of Zadie Smith's characters in White Teeth is an English-Irish horticulturist. Joyce is her name. She writes gardening books and proclaims hybridity for plants and for people as the key to survival in the tough new climate. In short, we've got to improve our human genes by mixing them up, just as we've done to our flower beds.
If it is not too far-fetched a comparison, the sexual and cultural revolution we've experienced these past two decades is not a million miles away from the horticultural revolution that has taken place in our herbaceous borders and sunken beds. But once we were satisfied with our biennials, poorly coloured flowers thrusting weakly out of the earth and blooming a few times a year if we were lucky, now we are demanding both variety and continuity in our flowers. The passionate colours of exotic blooms 365 days a year. In the garden, as in the social and political arena, change should be the only constant. Our parents and our parents' petunias have learned this lesson the hard way. The march of history is unsentimental, tramping over generation and its annuals with ruthless determination. The fact is, cross-pollination produces more varied offspring, which are better able to cope with a changed environment. It is said cross-pollinating plants also tend to produce more and better quality seeds. If my one-year-old son is anything to go by, a cross-pollination between a lapsed Catholic horticulturalist feminist and an intellectual Jew, then I can certainly vouch for the truth of this. Sisters, the bottom line is this. If we are to continue wearing flowers in our hair into the next decade, they must be hardy and ever at hand, something only the truly mothering gardener can ensure. If we wish to provide happy playgrounds for our children and corners of contemplation for our husbands, we need to create gardens of diversity and interest. Mother Earth is great and plentiful, but even she requires the occasional helping hand.
The hybrids see this world differently from the monoculturists. They're a lot more relaxed about diversity.
I don't think that globalism will necessarily diminish the variety of literary voices.
I met another hybrid soul in Jamaica, Colin Channer, a novelist who moves easily between Kingston and Brooklyn, New York. He is rooted in a small island that has global ambitions in Olympic bobsledding, quite astonishingly, also in track and pop music and literature. What I kept seeing in Jamaica was the invasion of American brands and voices, CNN, KFC, BET, modern vehicles of what Jamaicans label cultural imperialism. But what Colin Channer also sees is a new context where small countries get relevant in the big world. Their leverage is what Colin Channer calls the reggae aesthetic.
Reggae is more than a music. You know, reggae took Jamaican people out of a kind of binary discussion with Britain about colonialism and slavery, and that it broadened the range of subjects that one could talk about. Reggae also had this really broad emotional palette. You can go from anger to meditation to excitement to romance to eroticism to, you know, it's Rastafarianism, politics, it's socialism, it's philosophy, it's nutrition, right? And weed, the great weed, right? Reggae demonstrated a model of a narrative art that was its real power. One of the greatest achievements of reggae music is that it presented to Caribbean authors a model of art that could bring the ideas from little people in a small place to the world. Now, that is a model of assurance. And, you know, as V.S. Naipaul says, every writer needs a tradition to lean on. I'm paraphrasing Naipaul, right? Needs a tradition to lean on. Reggae gave the Caribbean writer that assurance that there was this tradition, right, that was respected around the world, right, and that it was okay to speak with passion about what you were seeing outside your window with assurance that it would be relevant to somebody far, far away. You know, when Bob Marley sings No Woman to Cry, and when Bob Marley talks about Trench Town, and when he talks about Trench Town with the assurance that everybody else will understand it, right? Marley's absolutely right, because somebody listening to No Woman to Cry in Johannesburg will realize that Johannesburg is Trench Town. Or somebody listening to No Woman to Cry in Alabama will realize that Alabama is Trench Town. Before reggae in Caribbean literature, there was always a tacit understanding that our experience was not universal, that it was local, right? And that, you know, Dickens's world was universal, right? Or, the world of Hemingway was universal, right? Reggae showed us that our world was universal, but that the universal power of our art would only come when we wrote so specifically about our locale, right? That it would put somebody far away into the mindscape of our experience. And that is where, you know, the work would get its universal power. In other words, the less you try to be yourself, the less relevant you'll be, the less global, less universal you'll be. That being creating art that is truly global comes from being intensely local and intensely specific, so that people can then see in clear relief how your life mirrors their own. In the government's yard, in
Trenchtown. The very Jamaican sound of that housing project in Kingston, Trenchtown, still resonates around the world. But for a lot of artists and cultural figures elsewhere, there can be torment in this modern transition, a sort of torture in finding a new identity. I felt it especially in Singapore, the richest little city-state since Imperial Rome or perhaps 14th century Venice. Against the peacock skyline of modern, global Singapore, there was an architect I wanted to hear from again. He had said something I'll never forget, that the human spirit has been proven invincible in the face of adversity, but that it may well be defenseless in the grip of wealth. Tae King Sun has designed striking modern buildings, homes, temples, a huge downtown hospital. He draws on a lot of Malayan motifs, and he builds for a tropical environment. His beef with most of Singapore's new world-class profile is that it ignores both history and geography. It has forgotten its Asian-ness and its equatorial climate, and it is patched over what's missing in authenticity with imitation and fizzy emptiness.
Well, the modern architecture in Singapore is completely copied from elsewhere. I mean, there's hardly any innovation at all. Most of the big buildings here are designed by American architects. There's nothing so wonderful about it. We are living in the tropics, and yet these buildings are huge energy guzzlers. They are uncomfortable. Street life around these mega structures are totally poverty-stricken. I mean, the city is empty at night. the central business district, like all central business districts which we copy, has no life. Why should that be so? I mean, you know, why are planners and architects constantly genuflecting on the altars of Western taste? I can't understand this.
In the global alphabet, K is for kitsch, the bad art of imitation and bubbly banality.
I describe kitsch as a narcotic, you know, because the pain of everyday existence is just too great. So we need a kind of anesthetic, you know, to dull the pain, you know. Kitsch is just a pleasurable form of narcotic, isn't it? And so you find all the major cities of Asia going through this phase. I mean, the change is incredibly fast, and people are highly disoriented. So you have the city center of all the cities in Asia having the steel and glass towers trying to look like New York or Houston. And then the surrounding condominiums are all kitsch. And that pattern repeats itself in every city, you know, Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta, Bangkok, Guangzhou, everywhere, Japan included. China is the biggest of all kitsches because it is going through incredible psychological trauma. When you have successful modernization pulling in one direction, the kind of reaction to that is a loss of identity and even a sense of alienation. And as a result of the pulling apart between modernization, power and wealth, and identity crisis, then something has to fill the gap in between, you see, and I think that is kitsch. Terror and kitsch are opposite sides of the same coin. They are simply reactions to the rapidity of modernization.
An antidote to this, says Tae Kheng Soon, may be resolute self-searching and self-expression in the midst of all this change. What's missing from the Asian skyline, Tae Kheng Soon says, is the Asian consciousness.
I think there has to be some kind of a toughness in the local sensibility. And I don't mean a kind of return back to the village or the return back to some kind of presumed golden age in the past, you know. I mean a kind of toughness in wanting to be yourself in the contemporary time. Can you really be a global citizen? I doubt it. Without having some kind of notion of your own self and your own worth. I myself have this question. Am I Chinese or am I Singaporean or am I a citizen of the world? I think any kind of thinking person in the contemporary world has to take his own existence and his own consciousness seriously. Otherwise, if you do not take your own consciousness seriously, then you are just simply an object of manipulation.
It may well be harder to be yourself in Singapore than it is in Jamaica. Tae Kheng Soon believes the real project in Asia is to break with the old conformity and authoritarianism, most especially in the new global China.
One artist I met, Chinese artist who migrated to Paris, said to me that the worst thing for the Chinese people is China. He said it in jest, but I think he's quite serious about it. China is a great a destroyer of the human spirit. And if you read Kao Sing Chiang's book, Soul Mountain, which is regarded in China as pornography, but he got the Nobel Prize for that book. And it's a very deep book. I mean, when I read it, I mean, tears came to my eyes. I mean, this man, there's a cry from the heart about the kind of conditions of in which the human spirit is being violated, almost as a reflex against the privations of everyday life. It's a horrific kind of existence. And of course, today it's being assuaged by all the glitzy buildings and, you know, lifestyle in the bright lights of Guangzhou and Shanghai and all these other places. And it's going through this. But there is, I'm told, a kind of resistance movement, artistic resistance movement, deep thinking intellectuals are beginning to emerge, particularly in Beijing, who are questioning these things. In Taiwan, there is a kind of deep dialogue going on also. In Singapore, there's a very small group of people beginning to address these questions of life in the modern phase and how do we actually address the kind of degradation of the human spirit, both by development as well as by deprivation. So these are the kind of deep issues that are there. Thank you.
So there is a taste of some differences among serious people. Jeffrey Sachs marvels at the biggest export boom in human history, the 24-hour pace of construction in the big Chinese cities, globalization at its best, he says. And Tae Kheng Soon warns you that the human spirit can be crushed by development, maybe faster than by deprivation. Will the human beings who live through all this be nourished and sustained by it, as the writers Zadie Smith and Colin Channer seem to think? Or will they be disappointed and degraded by it? Let's remember that the global fault lines and the divisions of entitlement run through our own country, too. Amber is the radio name of a talk show caller in Boston. She's a young woman without a country, without identity papers. She's been living in America for almost 20 years now, an impoverished guest at our rich table, an exile in our midst, uninvited, maybe not quite welcome. But she notices things.
I was born, raised in the West Indies. Therefore, like most West Indians, a la Colin Powell, I was born a conservative and I've been recovering ever since. I'm the strange little hybrid creature of the new world, the old world. I'm African as far as I'm concerned, because of where my roots are. I'm American in the big context of that word American, not the puny, tiny, small context it gets come to represent. I'm European based on having Scottish grandparents. I'm English based on the education I had. I'm Latino based on where my grandmother and one grandfather came from. And I was raised to believe there's nothing wrong with that. I was told that my dining room table, my dinner table, without the electricity, but with the hot piping food and stern lectures from an old grandfather, that was a fabulous thing to be. It was great to be able to enjoy Cuban jazz and yet want to read Dickens, to love Elvis and yet to love Calypso, and still know who the hell Picasso was. There was nothing wrong with that. That was encouraged at my dining room table. And I was told that was the heart of what globalism was. You would think that I would be eating this idea of globalism up, but I'm not. I don't know what that word means anymore. I don't know what globalism should mean, might mean, could mean in the present society. The only thing it appears to stand for anymore is the idea that an American businessman can pay a teenager in the Philippines, 5 cents a day to make Nikes so American kids can walk around the streets in them, and then turn around and resell to the Philippines, repackage rap music, allegedly from the American ghetto, and then we all sit around and pretend we're one big connected society, which we are not. We're further apart now than we have ever been before. We're just a lot better at buying McDonald's. That's it. That's all globalism has become today. I should be able, you would think, in an era of globalism, to see that world my grandfather kept telling me to go see, go enjoy. God put it there for you, girl. Go get it, go see it. It doesn't work that way. Things are tighter than they've ever been. I can't put this into fancy language, so I'll just say it in plain, simple terms. You can't get in here, here being America. You can't move around in here. There is nothing but fear and suspicion on the ground level, and Europe, is slowly becoming the United States of Europe as well. It used to be you could count on this notion of jobs that real, quote-unquote, Americans didn't want. There was almost a secret code that folks were needed to come here without papers, without their green card, to clean those toilets, wipes those kids' behinds, stuff like that. Now, no one's even hiring for those jobs anymore because, we might be the wrong God-worshipping heathens looking to do damage or threaten Mr. Ashcroft's national security, quote-unquote. Even that seems to be disappearing. Even that little small portal to globalism appears to be disappearing.
Amber, you live inside this country but outside the gates in a certain way of the society itself. What's it like to deal with the sort of the dark side of INS restrictions all the time?
You mean like can't mail a letter in the main post office of the city I've lived in?
Why not? Tell me.
Because I don't have a Massachusetts ID and a social security number. When I've tried to go to Boston Housing to report a landlord who is malicious, they will not let you in without that number. And either you leave right away or you sit there and you try to invent a lie, make up a lie.
Amber, you say it's tough to get into the society, but what about into the conversation, into the culture?
Yes, the great national and international debates and dialogue of our day. I'm supposed to
pretend. Are you sneering?
Yes, I am. I'm supposed to pretend at this stage that, the microphone has gotten bigger or it's being passed around to more people, but that's a lie. The microphone has not gotten bigger. The conversation has not gotten bigger. It is not being passed around to any new or different voices. it's the same people, the same voices at the same seats, at the same table. It's Rupert Murdoch, it's Bill O'Reilly, it's the New York Times, it's the Washington Post, increasingly all saying the same thing, full of sound and fury and signifying nothing on
saying
the ground level.
Saying what, Amber?
Representing their interests, the interests of the comfortable, the interests of those in power, the interests of the satisfied. They sure as hell don't represent the interests of those on the streets of Palestine or Roxbury or Detroit or Brixton. Those voices are being closed out even more. Those voices don't even have the option to protest and have it reported on the NBC Nightly News the way it actually happened. Those voices are becoming more and more frustrated. That is globalism. You know, there's a reason why Africa to Mr. Brokaw, Mr. Jennings, is nothing more than the place incubating AIDS or Ebola. It's not a place to go look for the African version of Dickens, you know. That's globalism. Wouldn't it be great if Americans could look at Africa and see a place, and I'm using Africa solely as an example, could see a place with millions of human lives, rich lives, diverse lives, interesting lives, lives that want to read and learn about Sigmund Freud and William Shakespeare, lives that might be the next Sigmund Freud or William Shakespeare, lives that could teach America and Americans so much. Wouldn't that be great if that was part of this globalism? Shakespeare and Port-au-Prince, debating Freud in Beijing, loving Billie Holiday in Berlin, eating jerk pork in Moscow, that's my idea of globalism.
Hmm.
We would be enjoying what it means to be human at its core, to be global, to be us.
That is one undocumented American's view of the many globalisms. The paradox is everywhere. Globalization is a way to wealth for some, to calamity for others. It's a byword for empowerment, also for a condition of helplessness. It's a race, it's a map, it's the 21st century system, a successor to the Cold War and to the ranking of first, second, and third worlds. It's an economic doctrine that liberates the flow of capital, regulates the flow of exports, and tries to stop the flow of people. Aren't we all wondering which of the global trends could kill us? Which could make us stronger? Or wiser? Or more human? We like to think of this program in Zadie Smith's biological terms as our own new garden of diversity and interest in the hybridized, herbaceous border of broadcast radio and the internet. Please visit our global community online at thewholewideworld.net. The Whole Wide World is a collaboration of Leiden and McGrath Productions and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, in association with WGBH Radio Boston. We had help from producers Ben Walker and Catherine Bidwell, from engineer Tom Tiger and Jake Shapiro of the Public Radio Exchange, Jay Allison of Transim.org, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, is our radio visionary. Thanks also to Keith Kaya Wilson, Justin Grote Lucian, Keisha Parsons, Josh Ward, the Christian Science Publishing Society, and public radio stations WCAI and WNAN on Cape Cod. Support for this program is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Leiden.
PRI, Public Radio International.